Tesla announces the D this week. Then later, we talk Bitcoin in the porn industry, the $1,200 machine that lets anyone make a metal gun in their own home. And what does Bill Gates have to say about Bitcoin?
This is Tony Sakich.
I'm Chas Ferguson.
And I'm Eric Martindale. And this is Decentralized.
Welcome to Decentralized. We have some awesome topics today, and we just wanted to get it started by talking about Tesla's big announcement. And Eric, I know you had a lot to say. I know that you're a big fan of Elon Musk, and there's other things you want to say. Other than the obvious, this is, you know, the D joke, which I'm from Detroit, so everyone calls it the D there, so I thought it was less funny than everyone else. So what do you think about this whole thing?
I'm really excited to see these guys shipping another product. At least I hope it's another product. I'm willing to bet that this is probably going to be a minivan of some sort. D just sort of reeks large to me. Yeah, so I'm really excited to see.
this is going to be good.
Yeah, so he sent out this tweet, which I thought was hilarious, and I just looked at it after I made this comment.
Was it a tweet of his D?
No, but he does say, "I love the internet. Comments had me literally R-O-F-L. No, it wasn't intentional. Glad I didn't mention the other letter."
Yes, which means either it's the V, or it's going to be renamed the DP, and either way, I'm more speculating on what it is. Like, this is the day before the announcement that we're recording this, so we have no idea, you know. Our spy is not reported to us yet that's within the Tesla organization, which I should say doesn't exist. I don't want them searching for some mole. But we don't know. It's interesting, though, and as someone from Detroit, you know, Tesla's really, really forced the big three to step up their game, which they needed to do. I've never seen companies that lacked innovation succeed, and you know, we can have political arguments for why they succeeded, but, you know, it's hard to see that and see a companies that are so adverse to innovation, and now they're being forced to innovate because of this. So you think it's an SUV and you think it's this. What do you think? Let's say it's not an SUV. What do you think other possibilities could be?
Well, weren't they planning a more economic model, something in like the $30,000 range?
That's what I heard.
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well. It may also be sort of a, I've heard speculation that it might be a driverless model. So if you have an electric car, purely electric cars, plus the sort of driverless idea, that would be extremely interesting. Google's been working on this for a long time. A lot of the major car manufacturers have been working on this for a while, and it's starting to become a reality.
Yeah, and they just legalized driverless cars in California, right?
California, Nevada, I think Virginia recently had a vote, and there's a couple other states that are sort of vying to become the test grounds for most of these vehicles, because you can't even test on the public roads because the vehicles simply are not legal, which sort of screams sort of anti-innovation to me.
Well, I don't know about that, because you know what? I bet there was some kook 20 years ago that thought of the self-driving car when the technology didn't make it possible, and that could have killed a lot of people. Not that I'm pro-regulation. I'm just saying you can never underestimate the public stupidity. People are dumb.
And yeah. I think the key there is like endangering other people versus endangering yourself. Like,
yeah.
It should totally be viable. It's just like, it should totally be okay to put any vehicle you want on a road, on whether it's publicly or privately owned, as long as you're not stepping on the rights of someone else. It's always about voluntarism, right?
I agree. And what would have happened to the Wright brothers? Because to me, that was a suicidal thing they were doing.
What?
But they innovated.
Well, okay, that's a great example. What if it was illegal to put a vehicle, an uncertified vehicle, in the air, right? Like, the National Kite Agency, you know, has regulated kites for the past, you know, 200 years. And therefore, it is illegal to come up with any other type of new device without registering it with the state, and subsequently you're not even allowed to test these things without going through us. Like, the airplane would have never been invented.
Well, then another country who didn't make it illegal would then, you know, advance further and people would do it there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Openness and freedom always win in the long run, which is why competitiveness is key here, especially on legislation.
Oh, yeah. But the other question is, how soon do you think it will be before all three of us, not necessarily just one of us, are driving electric cars?
Well, I don't drive cars, so it'll be a while.
Okay.
Okay, when will you ride in an Uber that's an electric car?
Yeah. I already have ridden in Ubers that are electric cars.
I've driven in hybrids, not electric.
Yeah, hybrids, that's fair. It couldn't be too long. Once they've achieved sufficient market penetration, it's only a matter of time until a Volt. Actually, no, I've ridden in a Volt before at Uber. I've already done this.
Isn't a Volt a hybrid?
Is Volt a hybrid?
I believe it was a hybrid.
No, Volt is a Chevy. That's their
Chevy
hybrid.
Volt,
100% electric.
I'm not now. I gotta let's fact check this because I don't want
to. I wonder if Uber has an API that I can query to see if what all of the vehicles of all the rides I've ever taken were. I bet
they should.
Don't.
Like the last FM of driving.
That would be pretty neat.
Like it scrabbles what car you're in.
Yeah, so long as I
sweet
it doesn't give away my data.
It's I guess a hybrid. They're hybrid.
Are hybrid.
They are hybrid. That's what I thought. Actually, one of my professors in college was on the engineering team for the Volt.
Cool.
And yeah, I do think it's coming soon. I think the charging station issue needs to be not confronted, but it needs to be handled better.
What do you think the charging station issue is about?
Is about incentivizing places to install them. I mean, you're really fighting an industry like the gas station, and not necessarily the industry, but the entire oil industry is so behind, you know, what their industry is. You know what I'm saying? And this is challenging them. It's a lot like with Bitcoin that it's challenging other legacy industries into doing something different. And you have to make sure that there's the right mechanisms in place for people to be able to charge their car. Now, obviously, they could do it at home if this is a capability and should be. But let's say they're going on a road trip or they're going, you know, somewhere else. I mean, we're lucky. Like, you know, we're pretty near one charging station I know for sure. But if you live in the middle of, like, Montana, good luck with that, you know? Very good, really.
So one of the things that I really like about Tesla is their transparency and openness. They sort of use that to combat a lot of the myths and sort of the concerns about these vehicles, right? They, you know, when they had the car fires, you know, they published all of their results. They published everything they
Unlike
could.
A certain other company.
It's just like, hey, please check the data, check the facts for yourself, which I think is necessary by these market leaders in order to encourage people to act for themselves.
Well,
yes.
Here's the important thing to think of. They're not market leaders. In the automotive industry, I don't know if you're familiar with what GM has been going through, but their safety recalls and how unsafe their cars have been and how much they ignored it as an organization have been a sticking point for them. And as it should be, you're putting your life, you know, you're going 90 miles an hour in a car, which I go 90, I guess you're not supposed to. But, you know, I want to know that it's as safe as possible and that it's not just going to blow up on me. And this has happened throughout time. And, you know, I love the fact that an openness really will, because there will be peculiar or interested people that are just really interested in it and saying, hey, I want to check this out and see what this is about. And they might find a flaw. And exactly. That's exactly what the automotive industry needs. It needs that more than anything else to truly innovate so we can get these flying cars that we hear so much about. You know, these are the steps that might actually make that happen.
Yeah.
Not, you know, industry closeness where they're just trying to maintain, you know, there's economies of scale to continue producing whatever they're making.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but on the note of transparency and openness, so if you go to teslamotors.com/supercharger, they have a map of not only where their current charging stations are open, but also where their planned charging stations are open. And they have a little slider, it may be D3 or some other JavaScript tool, where you can slide the slider and see where, you know, these charger stations are and what the range is if a vehicle is within range of that charging station is. So if you look at even, like, open right now, you can drive from, let's say you start in Vancouver, Canada, and drive all the way down to San Diego, California, in the south of California. You could drive all the way up into South Dakota, including a charging station within range that covers a decent percentage of Montana, by the way. And then drive across South Dakota, over to Wisconsin, right through Chicago, Detroit, all of these places, to the East Coast, up to New York, Boston, back down, all the way down through Georgia, and ultimately land in Miami, without ever having to park your car at a place that is your home or a neighbor, because they have charging stations within all of these ranges. And I think that that's amazing, that these are already open. You can already drive across the country. And if I recall, if you use one of their supercharger stations, you charge your car for free, right? Mm-hmm. You own a Tesla. You can charge at any of their supercharging stations for free. Now, as I recall, they also charge like, you know, $60 to do an instantaneous battery swap, which takes less time than it takes to fill a tank of gas. So you can literally pull into a supercharged charging station, replace your battery, and be out the door. I don't know if they've done that at all of their supercharging stations, but at least, like, look at the range on this. Like, today, I could hop in a Tesla and have, like, a month-long road trip across the United States purely powered by electricity. I think that that's awesome, and these other car companies are, will have to follow this model, right? Like, this is logically the best solution, right? Sell the car, make a profit on your supercharging stations by feeding energy back into the grid, and then provide that service to your customers. Why would I ever pay for gas again?
I think ideally, and I think it will be. I don't think it is now. It's too economically just not fathomable for most people. You know, people like me that never had a new car in their life until recently, and, you know, only will drive used for economic reasons, for obvious reasons. You know, the fact that this is the $30,000 Tesla, to me, that is the beginning of a game changer, because that's when you can start talking to, like, you can get people that just might be early adopters but aren't, you know, really wealthy, but are still like, you know, I don't really do this much, but I can get one of these. So I'm gonna try this. And no, it's no longer going to be a status symbol, but you also lose that fact where it is a status symbol, right? It's like Beats headphones. They're kind of crappy headphones, but, you know, people love them because, you know, it makes them feel like they're, you know, LeBron or something. Like, I don't get it, but others do, and that's what matters. So, at least in the marketplace now. But I do think in 3 or 4 years, Tesla is going to have this unlock, and I think they're going to have charging stations in all these, you know, what I would call dead zones, which are like North Dakota, Arkansas, Mississippi, other states. There are some places, but there's not a ton of population there, so it's understandable. I think what's going to really happen, though, is when the big three come in, they're going to fight this somewhat, but I think they're going to be forced to adopt a lot of this technology, and Tesla making it completely, you know, pretty much eliminating patents and saying, hey, take our technology. They understand that it's in their future best interest for there to be a standard to do this.
Yeah, I honestly think that they may be left in the dust because there will be new competitors that come to the arena because their supply chains just are not prepared to do this type of production.
Tesla?
No. The big three.
I disagree with that. The supply chains are. It's not. It's the brains that innovate. What's actually happening in the computer in the car.
Okay. So maybe they don't need the brains necessarily. They can easily license the technology from Tesla, which turns Tesla, instead of like a major car manufacturer, they become one of the major licensors because they're the innovator. They were the mm-hmm. producer of the technology.
The batteries, you're right. You're right about the supply chains for batteries, by the way. I was just thinking of the car mechanics.
Yeah, so okay, fine. But
I want to give you that point, yeah.
Absolutely. But Tesla also has innovated a lot on, you know, the drivetrain, the suspension system. They've got fundamentally a different type of car. They threw out, I think this is actually something that he said. He said, we threw out the rule book, and now we've reinvented pretty much everything from scratch, and subsequently we've come up with a fundamentally better vehicle, even if it's electric. So I'm really excited to see what the reactions of all of these other companies are being. Subsequently, I'm excited to see the D.
I want the D. I kind of want a D. For decentralized, boom. Anyways, we're gonna continue to talk about things that are interesting that aren't necessarily actually involving staring at a screen yet, and that is the ability to 3D print guns. And the fact that there's recently been something in the news that a $1,200 machine, as they're speaking of it, that lets anyone, sorry, I can't speak today, make a metal gun at home. This terrifies a lot of people, apparently, because, you know, they like to think that, and I say they, a lot of people really want the feeling like, oh, guns are all, you know, controlled, and, you know, we make sure that I want to know who has one and who doesn't. And my response to that is, for one thing, you'll never know everyone who has one. It's impossible. You can't, like, unmake guns. You can't go back in time and say, hey, I wish it was never invented too, but it was, so we have them. They're not going away. We're not going to get rid of them all. So people get terrified by this, and all I think is, like, I'm not a gun owner, nor will I ever be, but, you know, you're not going to stop them, so trying is really, really just not worthwhile, and this actually is kind of interesting. So yeah, I can't wait to see how people try to get it shut down and how much, like, society in general is failing to realize this is the future. The future is not relying on a gun manufacturer. It's going to be the ability to print one at home, thus making all of this, just all these arguments about gun control, completely moot and a waste of time to talk about.
Well, so that argument can be applied to just about anything.
It really can.
So, I mean, even if we go back to this car discussion, where rather than purchasing a car from someone, ultimately you'll just be able to order one or print one, mm-hmm. like, locally. You won't need a centralized supply chain. You won't need a centralized manager because everything can be ordered on demand, or constructed on command, on demand. I think that the argument around, self-printing guns or printable guns at home is largely surrounds, centralized power, because, okay, if there's this, obviously this common argument, right? Like, if you outlaw guns, the only people who will have guns will be outlaws.
Yeah.
Because they don't follow the law anyways. why would they follow the law of, oh, it's illegal to possess a gun, right? Like, no, they're going to get guns anyways. Okay, so let's assume perfect enforcement, and let's assume that that's not the case. Now, the government is now the only person who has the guns. So what is it that we do when we have an unjust government, right? Like, how can we ever replace that unjust government with one that is actually just? Well, unless we are empowered and there's a level playing field, regardless of our you and me, you know, whether you have a gun versus I have a gun, regardless of all of that, if we do not have the equivalent power as the government, then a dictator, we cannot overthrow an unjust regime.
Well, I think even if we did, we wouldn't be able to. Not in that way, just because the economy is not there, the economics aren't there, the ability of people to actually fight back or the willingness of people to fight back is not there. And I'm not saying we should. This is not some anti-government tirade where we're saying we advocate this. We're just kind of like going through hypotheticals. And also thinking where that's that argument of, you know, the King of England can come and take your property. I guess that's true, but like whenever I see militia groups, it's always like 30 really, really kind of hicky white guys that are, you know, in camouflage doing like really basic, you know, drills from the military. And it's like, really? You and your little guns are going to stop what we see in Ferguson? Really? Because I doubt that.
Well, that's I think that that's a PR problem. And I think a lot of people have that perception about individuals who are, you know, vehement about their own rights and vehement about defending their own rights.
Mm-hmm.
If someone comes to your door and says, I am heretofore seizing your property and using it as quarters, I'm a military unit and I need to move on to this next location. You cannot say no to me. I will be sleeping in your home tonight. I think that we should have a right to say no. I think that we should, and if they try to take that by force, whether it be a friendly force or an enemy force, I think that we should have the right to defend ourselves. And the only way that we're going to be able to defend ourselves is we have some reasonable ability to do so. And I think a lot of people won't realize the importance of this until there is in fact a person at your door knocking with a gun saying, give me all of your food and water, right? Because, you know, something is happening, the Ebola virus is, you know, scattered, you know, across the United States, or, you know, martial law is declared, or whatever it may
zombies.
Be. Zombie attacks, man.
Or zombie marshals. Well,
like, the best way to protect the people is to give the people the ability to protect themselves, period.
Yeah.
Right? You can't say, like, oh, I'm going to be some benevolent, you know, protector, right? And have everyone trust you to be able to protect everyone. Well, what happens if that one benevolent protector fails? Well, now everybody's screwed, for one, because nobody has guns. And number two, it's like a better model would at least be have, like, you know, two or three or four different options. Let people have the choice who protects them.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
But the only way that that will ever emerge is if people are empowered to protect themselves. And I think that this, as it was Amir and Cody Wilson has really championed this over the past few years, this ability to produce weapons for reliable self-defense on your own without having to seek an outside party is the definition of liberty and freedom. If you want to be able to protect yourself, you shouldn't have to go seek an outside party to do that.
I agree as an ideal statement of a lot of what you say. I just think practically it loses a lot. And it just goes to, it's like whenever there's something in the news where you hear a standoff or there's something like this, it's just, I see the person involved and I'm like, this person didn't think this through. Because you're not going to win that battle. No matter what happens, you're not going to win that battle. It takes massive amounts of people to fight back on this kind of thing. The reason that the Revolutionary War happened and it was successful was because, for one thing, we were in terrain that was very unfamiliar to a lot of the folks that we were fighting, right? It was terrain that the people here that came here as colonists, and they were able to see the terrain, they were able to learn the terrain. It was home turf for them. So they were actually able to fight these grand armies because of transportation issues and because of ground knowledge, right? They were able to figure this out. They were able to win that revolution, right? And you look throughout history at who wins revolutions, who loses them, and you know, we've never lived in a society where information is this easy to access, but we've also never lived in a society where people do feel more confident in how much they can do. And I mean that as a good and negative thing. And I don't think that kind of coordination that exists for us centuries of building this established corporation, aka the government, and the resources they have, the supplies they have. I think that is, if you're depending on a gun to defend you, you're losing the battle immediately. And if you're depending on a gun to enable your freedom, you're going to lose again. There's many ways that you can defend freedom, and I think that there's many better ways to defend freedom, because that doesn't win hearts and minds. That angers people no matter what. You're never going to win that. And I'm not saying you said that either. I'm just saying in general. That's why I don't necessarily think, whenever I hear the gun crowds that are pro-gun, I'm not anti-gun. I'm not pro-gun. I'm very much like, they exist. Don't really concern me. They're a lot like, you know, reality TV. It exists. Doesn't really matter to me. And, you know, and my dad was someone who was actually shot, right? My dad was shot and robbed. So it's something where it does have, you know, there is a little family issue there with that, but it's also something where I can't stop that. I'm not going to blame the gun manufacturer. I'm going to blame the person that did it. And, there's all kinds of defenses and arguments, and it's always a talking point, but it's also something where when I hear it, I'm like, can't we get over this? Like, can't we really get over this? Because it's always the people that are talking about guns, they're people that I never want to talk to in the first place because they're crazy. And the people that are very anti-gun are crazy, too. It's like, what about hunting? I have no problem with hunting.
So are you anti-Sharp Rock? Or pro-Sharp Rock?
No. You know why? Because Sharp Rocks exist independent of me existing. I can't be pro or anti that. Right, it's like abortion. Exactly. I can't stop abortion, neither can people. All you can do is just try to say, hey, let people go do their thing and, you know, make it as safe as possible so as few people get hurt as possible. I feel the same way about guns. Guns are terrible. I can't go back in time. Can't do anything about it. Let's do what we can on this and make things better in other ways. Let's innovate. And yes, this is innovation. I don't think that was the point of 3D printing. To me, there's way more useful things for 3D printing, actually. But none of them make as bold of a statement as printing a gun. I admit that. It's very symbolic. People love to have their NRA sticker on their car. And I'm like, you know, that's a reason that people in the NRA get a bad rap, is because people are seen as gun nuts. And it's like, it's one of those problems that people talk about a lot. And there's problems that we can actually fix, right? That's not one of them. So why are we wasting our time? And I mean that as humanity.
Yeah. So I would contend that the reason the Revolutionary War was won was because the people had the ability to defend themselves, not necessarily because of the land, because they knew that land, but because every home had a weapon. And every home had a weapon because a weapon was necessary.
The same weapon as the enemy had, not more advanced. Like, the enemy did not have
equal
more advanced
weaponry.
Weapons.
Correct.
Right. We don't have equal
weaponry. The only way the people can win is if there's a level playing field,
yeah.
Right? Which is why it's so essential for, you know, people in the government, the military, needs to have similar tools available to them that the people do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they won is because guns were necessary for survival then. You had to hunt and kill. You had to...
They were necessary. You know, people survived before guns.
Every single family in the Revolutionary period had a gun.
You're right, but that doesn't mean they were necessary to survival.
It was absolutely necessary for survival because without, you know... Bow and arrow would be it's an ancient weapon even
yes.
at that time.
Yes.
It was an ancient weapon. It's like saying like, oh, you're allowed to have slingshots today, but you're not allowed to have a weapon or a rifle. You're allowed to have handguns but not rifles, or rifles but not handguns. It's silly. It's utterly silly. Like, people should have the freedom to have the devices that they choose to defend themselves or to go out and do whatever they would like to do, so long as they're not infringing or imposing violence on others. Only acting in self-defense.
Absolutely. And I think when it comes down to doing things that people enjoy to do, another point that I wanted to talk about was porn, right?
Mm.
Porn is pretty awesome. So there's lately been a little bit of a movement, not lately, it's actually been for a couple of years, about using Bitcoin for indie porn. And it's always been used, but now there's more of a necessity for it because of something that's going on. I don't know how familiar you guys are with this, with Operation Choke Point. And this is a very informal recommendation that the government's making to financial services, banks, and among others, to basically weed out undesirable industries, including, you know, payday lenders, and, you know, cash for gold, I think is one of them, and porn. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with porn. It's very legal, you know, and I bet pretty much every congressman watches porn. I bet some of them have been with porn stars. In fact, I bet a lot of them have been with porn stars. That's just speculation, but all I'm saying is that's probably what is happening. Anyways, I'm like, am I going to get sued? No. And then you see something like Bitcoin, which to me is just perfect for this because it bypasses banks, you know, and I don't mean that in a positive or negative. It just does. And here is the ability of people that are actually, you know, trying to contribute to society. And sorry, I view it as contributing to society. and they're getting paid for it in a way where they can kind of set their own terms. They're not dependent on a bank. Banks can't shut down their bank account and say, hey, you have 30 days. You need to move your money to another bank. There's no, you know, it's a legal service they're providing. There's no reason they should have been cut off from banking in the first place.
Yeah, there is, okay, there is no world where it is okay to tell someone that you're wrong to do something and be, you know, be the authority on that. You know, it's imposing your own morality on someone else is absurd. And having a government, whether it be an agency or a senator or whatever it may be, imposing, saying like, oh, you know, this is immoral and you shouldn't be doing this. And then being so, you know, covert as to, you know, impose their morality by such a side channel by saying, oh, hey, Mr. Payment Processor, why don't you impose some pressure on this other industry? Because you and I would both know, buddy, right, that these guys are doing things that are wrong. If someone wants to go make porn, so as long as no one's being exploited or, you know, being forced to do things against their will, so what? I mean, I'm not a big fan of the porn industry, personally, right? Like, I don't subscribe to all of that.
Wait a minute. Hold on. I want to specify, I said indie porn, because that to me is not the porn industry. I want to separate the two, because I consider them two separate things. Huh. One, I think, is more exploitative than the other. One, I think, is actually a lot of people making their own living, you know, and being a cam girl or having a web show, whatever it may be. To me, that's a little different than a company like Vivid, you know, like signing contracts and doing that. I'm less of a fan of that than I am with the other.
All right. Well, I don't know very much about any of that.
Oh, I do.
But, okay. All right. Well, it shouldn't be anyone's, like, moral prerogative to tell them that they can't do something.
Absolutely.
So long as everything is voluntary and opt-in, whatever happens over there, let it exist. I'm going to choose to not involve myself in it.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, someone should choose not to involve themselves in it if it's truly not something that is forcing someone against their will. So whatever that means in terms of the various types of porn or whatever it is, so be it.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting, though, that the government has had how many years to try to actually stop this? And where it was much easier on their end to stop this from happening on the internet. I'm not saying it could have. I'm just saying it would have been easier. And they choose now to go for this route where, you know, it seems odd to me that industry was tied in with the others where, you know, apparently a lot of people like getting their porn on the internet.
It's funny.
That's what I hear, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's very odd that this happens at this time, especially in a time when so many people are having negative feelings toward banks in general. It just does not seem like an opportune time, because I think in general people like porn. There's a lot of people that maybe the older folks and the people that are maybe like a little or easily offended may not, but speak to most, you know, 9-to-5ers.
So that's interesting. You said, like, older people and how they may be more easily offended, and maybe the younger generation is not.
Yeah.
I see that, too, and I wonder, what do you think that it is that is causing this shift, and what spectrum upon which is this shift actually happening? What moral acceptability spectrum are we actually talking about here?
I don't think anyone knows that answer, but I think the reasoning is that you and I grew up a lot online, right? You know, but I also lived the first 12 years of my life with really no internet. Like, my existing computers were video game consoles, right? So I remember being 10 and the fact that, like, if you saw a naked girl, it was a fucking huge deal. It was like, if you were a boy and you were 10, it was like you hit a home run because you finally saw it. And I mean a picture of it. Like, it was just didn't happen. And then it became something where now, if you're 10, you can access it in a second. And guess what? A lot of those kids that were 10, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, they're growing up and they have a little different outlook, but they're fine. There's no problems with it. It's not going to kill you. And, you know, I think that there is an acceptability among people at a certain age that had access to that. You know, and then you speak to someone where, you know, it was like 30 or 40 years ago when that kind, the person that watched adult films or skin flicks, as it was so lovingly referred to in the 70s, had to visit a very seedy part of town to go watch it in a theater or go get a little show and pay in a seedy area with other people that look seedy or that they were perceived as seedy in order to exist. Now it's like, you don't have to leave the house. You have to go to, you know, it's a lot easier on all ends. So I think you're seeing, on all ends. I think that you're seeing very much, you know, people getting over that are younger, and people that are older that don't have access to this, they have no idea what Two Girls, One Cup is. They don't know what Goatsy is. And I'm not saying that anyone really needs to know what those two things are, but those two things are a fact of life for a lot of people that are younger, and they existed, and people have had it done to them. I mean, not physically, obviously, but digitally and pranked. And you should see the awkward looks I'm getting now. I wish this was a video podcast. Like, why are we talking about this? But I mean this. Like, the perception of all of this has changed drastically, again, because of what I always come down to, access of information. People have more access to these kind of things now, so it doesn't offend them. You know, there's way more offensive things. Watch one of those ISIS beheadings. That will scar a kid for life. Seeing boobs, or seeing even hardcore, nowhere near as bad. And people now kind of understand that. And you go, okay, the news is way more violent than anything on a porn site. And it's slow, like any other change is, but it's a perception change. It's the same reason parents flipped out in '50s about comic books and started the comic code. And, you know, and it's been happening since. It's history repeats itself in different industries in different forms. That's all that is.
Yeah, so that's interesting to me also, because I wonder if sort of like this increased availability of pornography and all of these things contributes to sort of this continued, maybe what I perceive as a decline in respect of the opposite genders. It seems like there's a lot more mistreatment of women from men, and a lot of times a lot more mistreatment of men from women as well, equally, certainly leaning towards the female gender, obviously, than there was, say, like, you know, the history that I understood, you know, 30, 40 years ago. There was a lot more respect for women, and you would never speak a single harsh word to a woman at all. But it seems like a lot of younger men today are very vocally verbally violent, don't treat women appropriately, and similarly that reciprocation is not there either. Do you think that there's a loss of respect as a result of this type of exposure?
Not at all. I think that's because men historically are assholes. I don't think that has anything to do with women, and I think that has nothing to do with a lot of these things, because I think as much as you said there was more respect 30 or 40 years ago, women were restricted to doing very few things. The housewife role was considered to be normal. I mean, to be fair, 100 years ago, people believed female hysteria was a thing. And I don't know if you're familiar with what they thought that was, but that was, you know, basically where you bought a vibrator for your wife so she wouldn't go into hysterics. This was a legitimate medical issue in society. Times are way better for women now. The problem, though, is communication methods are different, and guys have always been and will continue to be assholes, and there's not really much you can do about that. And yeah, guys are assholes on the internet, but, you know, I think when it comes down to this, and I hate when you get a negative reaction to this, because I'm not defending anything anyone says, the best thing anyone can do in real life is different, but on the internet is ignore the trolls. Ignore the trolls. As soon as you acknowledge them in any way or form, that you win. And so when I hear, when I hear about this in real life, I have a different perspective, just for the record. But when I hear about, you know, they made bad comments to me, I'm kind of like, it's the internet. Like, I expect that. If I post one thing, I'm expecting 10 people to flame me, no matter what it is. And I'm not saying they should expect that, but I'm also saying that's the internet. But in real life, it should be a lot less accepted. I'm not saying it should be accepted online. I'm just saying, people are idiots, and people are always going to be idiots. You're not going to win that battle. It has nothing to do with respect, because someone who didn't respect women 10 years ago is still not going to respect women. And, you know, the best you can do on that matter is just try to make them as least important as you can in society, so their voice means nothing. That's the most you can do. And I think people in general do that, and in general. And a lot of people are just jerks. And you're completely right. People are completely just idiots and disrespectful and assholes. Ask a girl who's been on a dating site recently about the guys that talk to them and what they say to them. And I'm sure it's not going to be pretty. It'd probably be really funny, but pretty. But not pretty, I should say. And it's also going to make them, to be fair, though.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about, though. It's like, how is it that it is acceptable to speak to other people in that way and expect these types of behaviors from people? I don't think that, you know, if I was mailing a letter to someone, you know, 50 or 100 years ago, that would have been the way that I would talk to someone that I'm courting.
Well, you also had to pay for that, and it was much harder to do, and it wasn't instant. There's many variables there.
That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying that it's this sort of, it's like a download slide, but.
It is, but I think, you know, there is going to be, I should say, I don't even speak on this right, because as soon as you're a guy and you're in this position, you realize whatever you say, you really can't win. And my opinion of it is kind of moot, because I try not to be an asshole. I try to be respectful to women, but in the same token, I can't, you know, I can't wag my finger too much because I'm not a woman. I don't really go through it. I just kind of know what I hear.
Well, I mean, it, same in any direction. But, I mean, similarly, I don't think that it's appropriate to forcefully diminish someone else's opinion. I think that everyone, you know, has a right to share their opinion, which is why, you know, net neutrality on the internet is so important, why this porn thing and being able to publish whatever you want. The internet is the publishing platform. You no longer have to go to a publisher to get your opinion out or get your view, your perspective on the world out. I think that's the fundamental thing that I'm trying to get at here, is that, like, everyone should be able to freely share their information as they please. But I wonder what the impact of that is over the long term.
You mean the impact on personal relationships?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you start talking about these dating sites, and it's disgusting what I've seen on some of them, right? It's utterly disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe my perspective is skewed, but I can, in my heart, I don't ever see that type of language happening from like 100 years ago or 300 years ago, right?
I wouldn't either, but I also would say there's not enough language that is preserved, that is captured.
Yeah.
You know, now we have an infinitely larger sample size to go and look at. So, you know, I think it's one of those things, though, where what I want to do in the next few weeks is actually book someone that's a female, because this is apparently a very male-dominated show. Besides Stephanie Murphy, we have not had any other females on here that can speak a little more intelligently on this from her perspective. And I'm not saying we're not speaking intelligently, we just have different perspectives, and that's obvious. A lot of it, I think, has to do with also the fact that it's men, and men are trying to get laid all the time. It's true.
How's that any different? Yeah. This sort of, like, split between males and females. Like, why is it men are stereotyped as this?
It's kind of true.
The female have a stereotype.
Well, it's kind of true. If you go to a bar, the men are the ones that are expected to go and speak to the women. Not that there's not exceptions on both sides.
That's
the way
only
it works.
In this Western culture, right?
Right,
like,
right.
Like I'm sure that there are many other cultures where maybe the women are more dominant, right?
Right.
That has to exist, right?
Yeah.
But.
Yes, I think there's a lot of ifs or ands, and that's when it comes to male and female relations in general. That's why there's so much contention between both parties on it. And that's also why I don't think we'll be able to ever come to an answer on it. But what we could come to an answer on is what happened over the weekend and this wall that happened in this Bitcoin. What's the word you use? Consolidation, not crash, Eric?
Oh, just this past week?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, since December, we've had a big drawback from the peak price of $1,200 to, I think the current right now is about $340. I think that that's just a normal pattern. It's the drawback. We've had the price go up and down a few times, since then, slight fluctuations, but overall downtrend. This is normal market behavior in such a sort of a new market, this new concept. I mean, this is frankly unprecedented up until this point and may represent the single greatest moment in human history up until now. I'm not too phased by it. I think there was some interesting things that happened over the weekend in the slaying of the bear whale. In markets, you know, the bear is the one who believes the market's going down and the bull is the one who believes the markets are going to go up. Obviously within crypto and Bitcoin specifically, there's been the pressure between the two different communities and the opinion often sways, right? Like, oh, Bitcoin's going to go up to, you know, $10,000, you know, and those are the bulls. And then that may be the predominant opinion to the moon. Whereas, you know, the predominant opinion sometimes is when things are looking really bad, people start to change. Oh, maybe it's going to crash, and they start to believe that it's going to go down. And so they start shorting and selling all their Bitcoin, and then they regret their decision because the price swings back up. But the bear whale was supposedly, he's a whale in a market, as someone who holds a lot of capital and has the ability possibly to move the market. The bear whale was someone who perceivably, based on the current outstanding positions on some of the markets and some of the perception, like what was happening in the price, was someone who's, people were saying that they were pushing the price down. There's no person behind it necessarily. There's just, this is a force that has existed out in the markets. And the slaying of the bear whale, has effectively been these new entrants into the market or, the buyers, who basically just tore through this large set of orders that existed on the markets. And if you look at the charts, you know, you sort of see these common charts of a zigzag across the line, and, you know, buys and sell and the prices going up and down as people do their trading. Then the bear whale was in the process of being slayed, and it was the greatest showdown of Ultimate Destiny. And, there was just a horizontal line as the wall, the amount of Bitcoin that he was trying to sell, were just chewed through by people who believed that it had a stronger, higher value, and people who were trying to buy those Bitcoin. So there was just a solid line, perfect horizontal line, as people, bought those Bitcoin. Now, what, I don't think this represents any particularly significant moment, other than just it's a function of the normal market behavior. As we move forward into perhaps the next bubble cycle, for Bitcoin, I think it's the same thing as any. The volatility today is way less than it used to be. This is just a sort of a feature of the current market state. The volatility is decreasing because the forces of people who want to buy Bitcoin, and the forces of people who want to sell Bitcoin, those forces are increasing, and they're above and below the equitable exchange, the value, the perceived value. And as the surface area between those two forces increases, so too will the stability, because it basically forces that price into a common line, because there's much more buyers and sellers for that surface area to exist. So, you'll start to see more behavior of this. In this case, it was manifested in the form of volume. And as the volume of Bitcoin continues to increase, the volume of Bitcoin exchange, so too will this behavior. But you'll see it over a much wider period of time.
Yeah, I think that does seem to be an inevitability as well. This, I'm not going to lie, as someone who was looking at the price, I kind of was like, oh boy. But, you know, I've had that oh boy moment a few times, and it's always kind of, in a weird, remarkable, alternative way, been actually stable and, you know, always existed at the end. It wasn't like, I think there's... There's a certain group of people that really think that overnight Bitcoin's going to disappear.
Yeah.
And I think I have no, that will not happen. Not happen, impossible. But.
So you're a bull.
Yeah. Well, yes, in general. But, as an investment, I would say that.
Yeah.
As a technology, I'll also say that, but in a different way, where I will say that if you're expecting that, then you're looking at it. Cause that's the other interesting thing is there's so many different ways to view Bitcoin, right? If you're just viewing it as an investment, I can see why you may be negative on it. If you're just viewing it as a technology, it really is a different perspective. And I think you need to go in with that perspective, which leads me to, and this isn't, you know, necessarily something that was huge news, but I love talking about this guy because I think he just is like one of the dumbest people that people actually view as smart is Paul Krugman. Who is very negative on Bitcoin and said it was evil in the past. And by the way, this guy has a PhD, which stands for Player Hater Degree, and he's from New York.
He also has a Nobel Prize, as I understand it.
Yeah, well, writes for the
Obama
New York
has a Nobel Peace Prize. So.
Yeah, and there's others that are pretty negative in general that have Nobel Peace Prizes throughout history. I don't see that as really anything. But he made another comment saying basically that it was, you know, it's bad. And this coming from the genius that thought the internet was going to be as, you know, like fax machines or something. And it does give you a perspective on what not necessarily average people think, but what people who are not interested in technology think. And it really, it's interesting to me because it just makes me laugh in every way possible where it's like, can't you see this a little bit?
Yeah, so I saw a really interesting exchange in the comment thread on a post recently, where when one person says, like, you know, well, you know, what does the average, you know, auto worker in, you know, middle America care about Bitcoin right now? And the reply from VC, notorious VC Fred Wilson was, well, you know, they didn't care about the internet in 1993. Why would they care about Bitcoin not right now either?
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, just sort of like highlighting, you know, how early we are actually in Bitcoin's development. I mean, it's going to happen way faster than we anticipate, but, I think at least a lot of people will anticipate, but it's still going to take a matter of time.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
Right. Like Bitcoin has little apparent utility right now. To the average, you know, American citizen, U.S. citizen, to the person who's operating a farm in Sierra Leone, right? Very little utility as of right now. But as time progresses, it will gain more utility. So I want to share a quick story about Paul Krugman. When he wrote his first, one of his first articles, actually no, he wrote this I think in 2013. He wrote an article about how Bitcoin is evil.
Yes.
Right? He's written a couple articles about Bitcoin and his economic analysis of what it is and why it is. And, you know, ultimately he comes across to me as just a generally negative person. But I was speaking with the former general counsel, if I believe it was for American Express, a very, very intelligent woman. And I didn't realize this at the time. I was just having a casual conversation. I was, of course, very excited about Bitcoin at the time. I'd been involved for a year or two at that point. And I was just sharing what I thought about Bitcoin. And she asked me, oh, did you see what Paul Krugman has said about Bitcoin? And I said, yes, and I think he is ignorant, a fool, and he does not understand the gravity, or let alone the technology, right? Or the technology, let alone the gravity of what its implications are. And the fact that, to me, that Paul Krugman has so obsessed about Bitcoin, frankly, he's said a lot of things about Bitcoin. He's clearly paying attention to it, simply indicates to me how much it's really bugging him, right? Yeah. It's really bothering him. He may be very intelligent. He may be ignorant and just simply well-learned. But it doesn't matter. The fact that that he is so consumed by this idea that he's continuing to talk about it and think about it, just shows me that, you know, this is something that truly, that my vision of this actually changing the world is probably accurate. So it's a little validating. But similarly, I think Bill Gates also has recently talked a little bit about Bitcoin.
More positive than negative on his end.
Well, Bill Gates is also a technologist, of course.
This is true.
Right? And, you know, he founded Microsoft and he actually wrote code, right? So he had really positive comments, sort of hopeful. What did you think of his comments, as opposed to Paul Krugman's, in contrast?
Well, I think the comments where he spoke about how a decentralized currency doesn't necessarily need to be anonymous is actually true. And I think that was interesting, and I think he's right in one aspect, where that's probably going to be viewed as a negative by some that were on the fence, because they're going to think, oh, people are buying guns with this, people are buying drugs with this, and, you know, other bad things. But, you know, again, technology is a tool. A tool is never positive or negative. It just is. And I think Bill Gates gets that too. So he's kind of saying, okay, well, you know, he can see it coming. And I think with Krugman, and the other thing that I didn't really get a chance to mention is his view on economics, because I think what's going to end up happening out of Bitcoin, and this is another thing that I'm seeing, is we're going to actually understand economics way more than we ever have. There's so many theories, and there's so many different schools that are taught, and no school is correct. I've always said that on economics, I claim ignorance, because I say I don't think anyone has completely understood it. And when they do, I think there's some that get it more than others, and some that get, you know, I think Hayek is the one that said that, you know, there's things you can't understand. And when there's that many variables, that's something that you can't understand. I agree with him completely. But I think now we're going to have data that's going to help us understand this in a much, much more clear way in the future. And it's going to be a complete positive.
Yeah. So in that aspect, the transparency and openness of the Bitcoin network and the full non-anonymity of the network, will, in my opinion, be a source of knowledge and insight into the way that economics actually work. Actually work, because now we have quantifiable measurements. Let's imagine that, you know, 80 or 90% of, you know, payments around the world or commerce around the world runs through a blockchain, right? Now you can analyze all of these things and say, even if they're, you know, sort of anonymized and whatever, they're just, you know, public key pairs, right? Or a public key, you can analyze this data and understand a little bit more about it. Now Krugman, I'm pretty sure, you know, follows the Keynesian model, right? So, whereas the Austrian model, it seems, is built into Bitcoin, which is why I think maybe Krugman has so obsessed about it, because here is a, you know, an Austrian, economic model in practice, that is actually working and is actually functioning. And I think that's what bothers him about it, is that all of the commitments that he's made,
I agree completely.
Keynesian model.
Yep.
It's really just attacking him at his core, and he just cannot believe Maybe even that his entire life's work will have been wrong.
Which is something that I hope ever, it's something I hope when I get older that I can embrace, and is that, like, anything that you're taught is knowledge to you as of that moment. And as soon as you accept everything as truth, you know, call out everything.
Like, yeah.
Challenge everything. And I don't mean, and even the things you're taught in school, the things that your parents taught you, and I'm not saying they didn't mean the best when they taught it to you. I'm just saying, is it true? Is it really? Because people have a problem doing that. And I think that's where this whole economic debate happens. It's not a political debate. It's a, oh, I was taught this in school, therefore it must be the truth. Well, really?
Yeah.
Is it? I don't know. Is it?
The greatest thing that my father ever taught me was to ask questions.
Oh, yeah.
I questioned.
Poke holes.
Everything.
Yeah.
Always ask why.
Yeah.
And then you get the explanation.
And
well,
as,
why is that?
Exactly.
And then you get the explanation. Well, why is that? And then you get the explanation. And someone says, well, that's just the way that it is.
Yeah.
And they get frustrated with explaining it to you. But then you've gained so much more insight into why, and you get to, the ability to understand things. I follow this philosophy called Kaizen. It's a Japanese, it was commonly adopted, I think, by the Mitsubishi manufacturing process, where you just focus on constant improvement. That's what it means literally in Japanese, is constant improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And if I ever get to a point where I'm just so galvanized, right, that I simply cannot accept a new idea based on the pure premise that it's new, ignoring merit, right, based on the sole premise that it's new, then I've ceased to learn, and I truly hope that I never get to that point.
Me either. That does not sound pleasant. And, you know, I want to real quick actually quote Bill Gates on what he said here, because now I have it in front of me. Here's what he stated. Bitcoin is exciting because it shows how cheap it can be. Bitcoin is better than currency in that you don't have to be physically in the same place, and of course, for large transactions, currency can get pretty inconvenient. The customers we're talking about aren't trying to be anonymous. You know they're willing to be known, so the Bitcoin technology is key, and you could add to it, or you could build a similar technology where there's enough attribution that people feel comfortable that this has nothing to do with terrorism or any type of money laundering. And the fact that, you know, to me that last comment's actually funny, because, you know, we all use dollars, and that's used for money laundering and terrorism.
Well, it's back, like, down to the PR thing.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so if you look at this and you compare this PR thing, it was a big problem like a year ago. I think it's a far less of a problem now.
I think it still is.
Far less of a problem, but I think
Mostly because that was the introduction.
Agreed.
If that's your first impression,
yeah,
you're going to maintain that over a longer period of time.
And I think maybe there was a lot of people who got burnt, who basically have been burned for the short term, or even the medium term, on Bitcoin, because the first time they heard about it was, you know, Silk Road, or, you know, money laundering, or terrorism. It's like, what is that comic where it's like, you know, Uncle Sam and, you know, a politician, and it's like, I think it was some previous political comic, but they had overwritten the box, and they're like, you know, well, how it's like anti-taxes, but they overwrote, or taxes, new taxes, but they overwrote it with Bitcoin, and it's like, well, sir, how would you like this wrapped?
Mm-hmm.
Is it terrorism? Is it like, and it's like this lists off this, like, all of these crazy PR spins that you can use to, like, kill an idea or attempt to kill an idea. And I think we really need to focus on this. This gets back to, like, what you're talking about people who believe in freedoms and subsequently believe in gun rights firmly, and get angry when people say, you know, guns should be outlawed. The perception of those people is that they're ignorant, and that they're just, you know, just these sort of country guys out in the forest, you know, practicing militia laws. I think that's just another example of how PR, or how a perception, can be used to try to kill an idea before it really takes hold.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to be careful about that with Bitcoin. I find it totally amusing and validating that Bill Gates references that in his comment, right? Like, oh, or be confident that it's not used for terrorism or money laundering. Well, yeah. Compare Bitcoin, you know, and its currently $5 or $6 billion supply that's out there in the world. Compare the amount of Bitcoin that is involved in any sort of illegal activity to the amount of U.S. dollar, and I would argue even at a percentage basis, that is involved in illegal activity, whether it be money laundering or harmful activity. I would suggest that a far higher percentage of U.S. dollar or fiat or state scrip of any capacity is used for crime and harmful things than Bitcoin is. So I would even argue, and I would vehemently say this as much as I can, if I could have had a rooftop to shout it from, and everybody could hear me, I would say Bitcoin is an instrument of peace because look at how clean it is compared to your dirty state script.
Mm-hmm. Physically and, you know, emotionally, yeah. I would say. I agree.
Don't touch that damn greenback. You could probably get Ebola from it.
Yeah, probably. And we're in Atlanta, so you probably really could
maybe,
get
maybe that's
Ebola
what,
from
what
it.
Happens. Maybe yeah. Ebola becomes a thing and people become afraid of paper money.
Yeah, then we'll need to decentralize the Ebola vaccine. And that, you know, we need to get that first. I also think when it comes to, you know, the perception of technology in general, this is, again, always have to study history, study the AC/DC wars, study the, you know, as I mentioned in this podcast before, the horse and buggy versus the auto wars, you know, study these things and you kind of see that, you know, whatever is perceived as better, by the media. And again, also William Randolph Hearst's, war on hemp, that can become fact really quickly. The difference between then and now is we have ways that real people can get real answers and that, you know, not answers, I should say, but real perspectives on this that are different, that are a little more truthful. So you don't need to necessarily believe what you read in the newspaper because it's the best source you have. Because there's a lot of ways newspapers are extremely accurate and there's others where they're very, very much not. And, you know, and it also a lot to do with what kind of newspaper it is and what type it is and who's writing it. There's a lot of variables there. And the same with the internet, obviously. Don't believe everything you read on the internet either, but, you know, try to, you know, take it with a grain of salt and see what truth is there and what's not. And, you know, that is helpful, and that's going to help things like Bitcoin succeed eventually. Winning hearts and minds will be slower, but once they're won, like I said, once that light bulb goes off with Bitcoin, I've noticed, usually it doesn't go off. Usually it stays like, oh, this is the future. Like, this is going to happen. Maybe they're not going to buy all into it and invest all the, you know, invest everything in there, but they're going to at least believe
yeah,
that this is going to happen.
It's the cycle. And there's a couple phases that people go through, and it's like once you go down the rabbit hole, you've taken the pill,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it's like the red pill versus the blue pill. Once you spend, you know, that first time reading about, like, how Bitcoin works, maybe even, like, reading the first couple pages of the white paper, then it's pretty late for you. It's too late. You've taken the pill, and then you go into this week-long fervor of, you know, reading everything you can about how it works and how it can be applied, and then you come on out the other side of this rabbit hole enlightened, and you're just like, oh my gosh, this is the future. And very few, I don't actually know of a single soul that has gone through the process of understanding the blockchain. Let's stop talking about Bitcoin for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Of understanding the blockchain and whatever it takes for that person to get there. I don't know of a single person who's gone through that process and said, oh, well, this is a bad idea. This
yeah.
is not never going to work. Every person I know of either is like, wow, that's interesting technically. That has a lot of uses. Or they're like, oh my gosh, this is the future of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the people that I run into and I hold near and dear in my intellectual circles now believe this. And it really excites me to see what's going to happen over the next, you know, few years as a result.
What excites me are when the intellectual, I don't want to use the word elite, but when the intellectual leaders that are not the most tech savvy can start understanding. And, you know, maybe because they didn't grow up with it, they never had the exposure to it. When they start getting it, if they can get it, because if, you know, when I say that, I don't mean that in a negative way. It's just they might not be able to because they don't lack, they, if you lack the understanding of A and B, you can't understand C. But, if you can understand that, those are going to be the ones. And I think that the Bill Gates of the world and the like, people on his same level, you know, the Bransons, the folks that are investing and putting their money where their mouth is and believing that this is the future. To me, their acceptance of this and their, you know, willingness to put some of their capital on the line says a lot. It says a lot more than the price of Bitcoin or whatever it is today. It says a lot more about, you know, whatever negatives you hear or how it's covered or how the Google Trends report is. It's going, okay, these people are people that have made wise decisions economically and technologically in the past, and they're kind of seeing this pattern. And to me, that's the beginning of this, and it's really where, you know, it starts, because now the infrastructure has the capital involved to be built.
And they will. The people who do not have the capacity to understand it yet will eventually understand it.
Or not need to, because they won't even notice.
Exactly this, because if it is truly a better solution, maybe it takes, you know, 5 years, maybe it takes 20, maybe it takes 100, but at the end of the day, what's going to happen is that all of society as a whole, ignoring individual people, whether it's Bill Gates, Paul Krugman, Fred Wilson, or Mark Andreessen, for Christ's sake, no matter who it is, society will move on, and they will move towards the solution because there will be the individuals who are passionate, who recognize the power and the ability of something to change the world truly and genuinely. I don't just mean like in the simple, you know, startup capacity of, oh, we, you know, changed the world of messaging.
Which,
no, what I really mean is like fundamentally introducing something that changes the course of human history forever. Society will move towards that because individuals empower themselves with knowledge and individuals take action on that in the form of activism and actually writing code and building things that change the world.
Couldn't agree more. And with that being said, we're going to wrap this episode of Decentralize up. I just would like to thank my co-host, Eric Martindale, as well as the producer slash co-host who is producing and manning the boards all day today, Chaz Ferguson. Thanks and have a good week.